My hands are a little dirty.
So am I.
If you're gonna die, and you knew you were gonna die, and you could choose how, what would you choose?
There's kids in there, and I want to get them out.
Hey guys and gals, welcome to The Conduit Speaks, episode 3, and I suppose Happy New Year is in order. Waited a bit for this episode because there's a lot going on over at the website, and kind of wanted to time everything out where I published my top films of 2011, and then gave that a couple days to sink in, and did our year-end show here, where I'd go into a little bit greater detail as far as the picks that I made. I'll have to excuse me in advance. I'm nursing some kind of throat thing here, so I'm gonna try not to cough and hack my way through this too much, but just before I get into the films, one of the things that got me thinking, you know, being on Facebook and whatnot, you see all the, you know, Happy New Year and 2012, of course, lots of end of the world talk with the Mayan calendar ending and December 21st, 2012, supposedly being the end. I'm not even going to really address that, but one of the things that you really run into a lot are people making New Year's resolutions, and, you know, to each his own. If you like to kind of mark your life in that way and choose these, you know, dates as defining moments to make changes in your life. I've never really ascribed to New Year's resolutions, and I don't intend to make any again this year. And I kind of wanted to encourage everybody to just make resolutions on a daily basis. Don't depend on a calendar date or a turning of the calendar page or a new year to set these goals or these expectations that this year you're going to do this or this year you're not going to do that. I like to kind of take a look at life on a day-to-day basis and kind of strive for something on a smaller scale. I feel like watch a lot of people around me and a lot of friends make these resolutions and fail or not fulfill them, and becomes this big devastating setback where, well, you know, it didn't happen this year, but it'll happen next year. So maybe if you make them on a smaller scale, on a more regular basis, and just strive and work to achieve things on a smaller scale, then maybe these big monumental resolutions will take care of themselves. So that's my soapbox for the day. We'll get into the films here now. I did this list really quite a bit differently than last year. This year in particular saw me getting an opportunity to take a look at a bunch of short films. So I actually did a top five list of shorts for the year as well. And coming in at number five was Billy Pond's Doll Boy, which was a lot of fun. I think what really set this one off for me was the antagonist, the character of Doll Boy. You have almost this Humpty Dumpty, Tweedledee, Tweedledumish character, this egg-shaped, pot-bellied guy in these almost little rascal pants and suspenders and shirt and tie, but that wore this fantastic doll mask and did his damage with a sledgehammer. And the thing that was so cool about this film is that it opens up with a pretty disturbing scene, clown driving a van and holding some hostages, if you will, in the back of the van. Real disturbing kind of child trafficking stuff going on there. But once you get into the location and Doll Boy's turned loose on our unsuspecting group of teens, it's pretty much mayhem and some really good exciting kills with nice practical effects. And this one it just kind of hit me in that nostalgic place, but also kind of revisited the moment of a fun, interesting killer that wasn't taken too seriously, but at the same time, just had this wonderful relentlessness about him and this just silent nihilistic kind of drive, and it just made for a really fun, exciting, stalk and chase and smash the shit out of you with a hammer. So, number five was Doll Boy, and heading into number four was an incredible short film entitled Date Night. And Date Night was interesting and notable for the fact that it melded so many genres together. It's has a lot of comedic elements, very dramatic, and finishes off, kind of as a thriller, kind of a horror film. It's interesting in that it's got, two central characters, he and she, and a performance from Erin Cline as she that is really incredible, in the sense that she's able to swing between so many different emotions and portrayals in it, because she gets to do kind of quirky, she gets to do, fun and silly. She does fear. She's got some remorse. There's just a ball of emotions here. And David Fewett, who plays he, really holds down the fort in terms of the type of character that you get here. Essentially, a girl who decides to forego a night out with her friends clubbing to have a quiet night at home, and is before long interrupted in her home by a man who turns out to be everything that she's ever dreamed of. And then tables are turned and things go downhill rather quickly. The performances are fantastic. The whole thing is just tied together really well with the mood and the music, and it looks beautiful. And just another example of an incredibly fun and interesting and sometimes disturbing ride that a short film can take you on. And the director, Jason, who's affectionately referred to as Jupes, and I'm gonna butcher your last name, Jupes. I'm sorry. Farjalle, Farjalle. So that's Date Night at number four, and at number three comes Worm, starring Robert Nolan, And directed by Richard Powell and produced by Zach Green, the guys over at Fatal Pictures, who had a chance to talk to the last episode. Again, Robert is doing his thing as quite a chilling portrayal of a school teacher who, much like their most recent short that I had a chance to review over at the website, Familiar, you get a lot of that inner dialogue, and you kind of it's a window into a intensely angry and disillusioned man who you get to follow him kind of through a day at a school and his interactions with the world around him, the teachers and the students, and kind of the absolute disdain that he has for this world around him. And Robert Nolan is just fantastic, and Richard and Zach, they write and produce and direct these incredible films that really deal in kind of the darkness inside their characters and oftentimes inside us all. And the thing that strikes me so much with Worm is the fact that this inner dialogue, we can all relate to really, but it's the fact that the line that exists that is ultimately crossed by the lead character here, is a line that we all kind of look at on a regular basis, and I hope never truly consider crossing, but in these short films, the way that these guys do it, the line is looked at and stared upon and contemplated, and there's certainly a lot of tension that goes on wondering when or if and how that line will be crossed. And it's pretty brutal stuff when it does get crossed. So yeah, Worm was just one of those films this year, short or otherwise, that just punched me in the gut. So for number two, I picked a 15-minute short film called Brutal Relax, and this is readily available on YouTube and out and about. And this focuses on a character called Mr. Olivares, and you know that something isn't right with him. Some anger management issues. It opens up; he's being released from a stay in a hospital, but it's recommended that he takes a vacation. So he goes to a beach where he can just kind of relax and enjoy himself and find some solace, and then of course all hell breaks loose, and you have kind of a zombie invasion on the beach. And at some point, Olivares springs to action, and not so much to protect himself or save any of the sunbathers on the beach. He simply gets an opportunity to channel his inner psycho and just goes absolutely apeshit on these creatures and tears them limb for limb. And it's just an absolute balls to the wall gore fest, but it's handled so well. And the reason this was so high up on my list was just to be able to sit back and enjoy practical gore effects that not only don't take themselves very seriously, but take themselves seriously enough to actually put some time into the effects. And as ridiculous as they might be, directors Adrian Cardona and Rafa Dangra definitely put in the time and effort to make them interesting, fun, and also pretty gruesome. So yeah, Brutal Relax was really just an absolute gem of a short and a fun film to just sit and marvel at the ridiculousness. So that brings us to our number one short film of the year, which is Micro Cinema. And this film really took me by surprise. A few people had come into contact with me, and it was around the time that they were really trying to drum up some interest in and support of this film, and also Harvest Tide Productions, which is a great company that is working on a series called Long Reach that'll be coming out soon. But the thing about this short film is that it does more than just flip things on its head. It starts off, you're getting this sit down with the main character who essentially, in what I think is just a fantastic monologue, lays out his plans for not only his bigger picture life's plan, if you will. He's clearly unstable and planning and wishing to inflict a good deal of pain on the world around him. So you get to see him sitting in his living room with the tools of the trade laid out in front of him on a table. He's got a mask on, and he's kind of getting ready to document what will be his plan for the day and for the future to set out to stalk and kill an unsuspecting young woman. And as I said before, the dialogue's really chilling, and this is written and directed by Skip Shea, who has all kinds of things going on and coming out in the future, one of which, as I said, is the web series Long Reach. And it's actually actress Emily King that started this ball rolling. And I think what's just so great about this film is there are plenty of plot twists and things that happen to catch you off guard in film, but the twist and finale in this one literally left me with my jaw completely open and on the floor. It's disturbing. There's the use of imagery and sound to go along with the action, and what's happening is just downright chilling. So Micro Cinema was my number one short film of 2011, and the primary reason being is that the viewer really feels like the rug is pulled out from underneath them. It turns out really the whole runtime is devoted to this setup, and although it's very short, it's very powerful and really quite a cautionary tale. So you can check them out if you go on Facebook and check out Micro Cinema's Facebook page or Google Micro Cinema. You can watch the short film on their site and also get really interesting sneak peek at Long Reach, the web series as well. For 99 cents, you get kind of a look at what Harvest Tide and Skip Shea and all the fine people over there are doing and what they have coming up. So I'd highly recommend that. The short films were interesting this year. I hadn't really been watching too many, but 2011 kind of turned into the year of the short for me, where I was getting a lot sent to me. And the other notable short that I want to mention is the guys over at Fatal Pictures, their film Familiar, which was another fantastic entry. And I saw Worm much earlier in 2011, just saw Familiar recently. And I really kind of had to make a choice there because I really enjoyed both of them. For me, Worm kind of resonated a little more, but also I didn't really think it would be fair to have two short films from the same people on the list. And for whatever reason, I'm a little bit compulsive with things. Five seemed fine to me. There really weren't, 10 that I thought I wanted to distinguish, and six is just an oddball number. So for whatever reason, I'm strange like that. I needed to round it out at five, but Familiar is another short film that I would definitely recommend. So those are the top five short films for 2011, as chosen by me, for whatever that's worth. And we'll be right back in a minute, and I'm gonna go down my top feature films of the year. So, before I get into my top 15 films of 2011, I certainly could have done 20. Don't have any clear explanation as to why I didn't, but it just felt too long, I guess. And kind of am of the mindset, for me anyway, that the longer a list gets, the less impact and the more it takes away from the films that you have on there. So there were quite a few films that I had on my list, and they kept kind of sliding and getting bumped around and moved down as the list grew, and I started seeing some more films towards the end of the year that I was really holding out for. And a few films in particular that I really want to make note of. David Blythe's Wound, in particular, would have been in my top three last year if I had just held out a little bit longer. It took a while for the screener to get to me, and I did my top 10 on the 22nd of December last year, and I think I got Wound a few days after and watched it, fell in love with it, and also Enter the Void, which was the same thing. I watched that at the very tail end of 2010. So those two, unfortunately, because of how neurotic I am, got left off 2010, and in my mind didn't qualify for 2011 because I didn't see them in 2011. So both incredible films from incredible filmmakers. Definitely check those out if and when you get the chance. Enter the Void and Wound. And then I just wanted to make a note of kind of five other films that I guess if I'd done a top 20, would have been numbers 16 through 20. So a film that was right there, kind of up until the very end, was Attack the Block, which I absolutely loved, but it ended up getting bumped because this is gonna sound ridiculous. It was just plain fun, and what happened was, as the year went on, I started seeing a lot more films that really had a huge emotional impact on me. So despite the fact that I loved Attack the Block, I think about halfway through the year it was in my top five, and I just kept bumping it and sliding it for that reason. There you have it. Another one that was actually there's a trifecta of Asian films that were on my list. The greatest of which being I Saw the Devil, followed by Dream Home, and then Cold Fish. I Saw the Devil was right up there, and Dream Home was just a fantastic story of a woman in crisis, kind of a social commentary, and the lengths that a woman is actually any person, man or woman, would go to kind of achieve their life's dreams. And Cold Fish, just really disturbing and quirky, gore fest in some cases, but just as Attack the Block started getting bumped and slid because of the impact that some other films were making on me, I did the same to I Saw the Devil, Dream Home, and Cold Fish. But again, in that order, I can't recommend those three films enough. And just to finish off with the fifth honorable mention, if you will, is the domesticated cannibal film We Are What We Are, which is a slower burn. It's more of a character study of a family in crisis who loses their main breadwinner and their father, wink wink, nudge nudge, and the children have to take over the act of obtaining the family's lifeblood. So, those seven films, particularly the five that I did see this year, that were kind of bumped and rolled down the list, if you will, are also fantastic films to check out if you haven't already. So let's get on with the list. 2011's top feature films for me starts off at number 15 with the film The Super. And this is not to be confused with Super. The Super, directed by Evan Makrogiannis and Brian Weaver, and starring Dimitri Kalas and Manoush, and Lynn Lowry. And what I absolutely loved about this film was the gritty, old school hearkening back to the New York of kind of the 70s and 80s feel of movies like Maniac and Combat Shock. And it's a story about a superintendent of a Queens apartment building, who kind of exists with these quirky characters who live in his building, and he just really ends up spiraling completely out of control. And with the help of Olga, played magnificently by Manoush, goes on a killing spree, and it's just absolutely nuts. But more than anything, like I said, there was just this incredible grit and grime to the film that It just instantly drew me in and captivated me. The performances are absolutely incredible, and the whole feel and flavor of the production is just absolutely pitch perfect for me. So that was The Super. At number 14, we have Embodiment of Evil. And this is a Coffin Joe film, and directed by Jose Mojica Marins, who also wrote it. Good old Coffin Joe. And what we have here with the film is, after 40 years in prison, the evil grave digger is released in accordance with Brazilian law, and he moves into the slums, where he has a bunch of people who look up to him quite a bit, and he's seeking out a mate to bear his children. All kinds of fantastic visuals with this one. He's haunted by the ghosts of his past victims, and the body count just piles up here. It's absolutely ridiculous. The guy's a psycho. You get him being chased down by a couple of brothers from the military police, who want to kill Coffin Joe, and they end up kind of coming upon all the mutilated and dismembered and remains of the people that he's killed. And this was another one of those films that just captured a mood and an energy so incredibly, and was also just a blast from beginning to end. Utterly filthy and disturbing, but as well as that, just some fantastic practical effects and gore work, and so good. Number 13 on the list is Little Deaths, and I'm not going to go into too much detail here. It's a UK anthology film with three shorts that kind of get more intense and depraved and odd and strange sexually and violently as they go along. I reviewed this on a previous episode, the first episode of us coming back, the Conduit Speaks episode one. So if you want some more details about that, you can go ahead and check that out. Number 12 is a film that my good friend Chris Halleck turned me on to, and a very odd and unpopular choice, as things have kind of played out on the website, Unhappy Birthday, which is directed by Mark Harriott and Mike Matthews, written by the same two. And it's a film that's set on a remote island, and involves three people coming in to kind of butt heads with the morality of the people around them, the community, and kind of has a Wicker Man feel to it. And it's a fantastically interesting film that really exploits the isolation and the madness of the setting. It's kind of a birthday party that kind of goes awry. There's a couple and their friend that go to celebrate this, and little twisty-turny things that go on here, and our group finds themselves trapped and kind of at the mercy of the people and the things around them, not to give too much away. But I thought this was a fantastic ride, and it really bore down on your psyche and drilled its way into my mind. So yeah, Unhappy Birthday. Again, it's an unpopular choice, but I'm getting kind of used to having people look at me sideways when I announce this list every year. Number 11 was a very, very difficult one for me. David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. This was one I was holding out for. I love the original three films. What had me so interested in this was that it was said that Fincher was adapting the source material, not remaking the film. He will be doing all three. I thought, if possible, this particular film looked darker, more sinister, and I went in to watch it. And outside of two very solid performances by Daniel Craig as Mikhail Blomqvist and Rooney Mara as Lisbeth Salander, the entire cast is pitch perfect. And although it doesn't expand a whole lot on the original film, there certainly are elements to it that are deeper, darker, more disturbing. It pains me to say it, but Rooney Mara is an incredibly and vastly superior Lisbeth Salander. Fincher is an evil genius and an incredibly gifted visual artist, and the film clocks in at over 2.5 hours, and there's just absolute balls to wall action and intensity the whole time. It's a tough book to adapt because the material's so dense. From what I understand, there were over 350 pages that were excised from the book. There's a lot of background that's handed out during an incredible opening credits sequence, and I think it was handled absolutely brilliantly. And like I said, I have a tremendous reverence for the original films, but I had a gut feeling about this one, and it really, really delivered. So that was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo at number 11. Number 10, a film that I think is not getting the attention that it deserves is one called Scalene. And the interesting thing about this film is that it stars a young woman, Hannah Hall, who you all may recognize because she has those eyes, but she played young Jenny in Forrest Gump. And she turns in a pretty incredible performance here. It's essentially a thriller, and you have three different points of view that are told around. They concern the rape of a female college student by a mentally challenged or handicapped, whatever is least offensive to you, man, and his mom's revenge after he goes to jail for it. This film by Zach Parker written by Zach Parker and Brandon Owens, is absolutely chilling. It is the very epitome of the horrible, horrible things that exist in the real world, that make the most horrific, stories to retell. And I would highly recommend, Scaling. That film really messed with me. And like I said, Little Jenny from Forrest Gump, Hannah Hall, gives a great performance in this one. Number nine is Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. And again, this is another one that I'm not going to go into a ton of detail with because I talked about it on the first podcast here. So I will say just one more time, that directed by Sean Durkin, written by Sean Durkin, starring John Hawkes, who's absolutely fantastic, and Elizabeth Olsen as Martha, a girl who finally escapes the trappings of an abusive cult, and kind of her paranoia and mental and spiritual downward spiral after those events. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene is one hell of a ride, and pretty soul shattering, if you will. Let's see, number eight, The Innkeepers, from one of my favorites, Ty West. The House of the Devil was my favorite film of 2009. Hated Cabin Fever too, but excused that because of all the chaos that went on around that. I held out for this. It's now on video on demand before it gets a theatrical release in February. Written and directed by Ty West. Sarah Paxton is in it. It's comedy, horror, ghost story, thriller, drama, all rolled into one. We're kind of given a look into the last few days of an inn called the Yankee Peddler. Two employees there, they're kind of obsessed with revealing the fact that the hotel is haunted, and they are kind of subjected to some spookiness as some old guests, if you will, come for a stay. And I'm glad that I waited on my list for this one because Ty West knocked it out of the park. The atmosphere is thick and ripe as it was in The House of the Devil, and The Innkeepers was just an absolute thrill to sit down with and just enjoy and watch the performances, watch the story unfold. You get a few scares, lots of laughs, and it just feels like the direction that a ghost story and a kind of a haunted house film should be going in nowadays. It's just wonderful. It was a joy. Number seven, The Oregonian. Again, a film I was holding out for and finally got to see and absolutely adored. It's probably, without a doubt, one of the strangest, most unconventional films on my list from writer-director Calvin Reeder, starring Lindsay Pulsifer as the Oregonian. Again, that first episode of the Conduit Speaks podcast. This was one of those films I went over. If you want a full review, you can check it out there. There's also a review on the website. Not too much to say about this other than if you like real concise, linear storytelling, You either need to readjust your brain before you watch this or avoid it because it's an absolute trip and it falls into no discernible genre or category. It's a mind-blowing clusterfuck of brilliance. The Oregonian. At number six, we have Lucky McKee's The Woman. All the hubbub and craziness surrounding this film at Sundance aside, this is an incredibly nihilistic and depressing look at one man's hold on his family and the lengths he'll go to satisfy his obsessions, while at the same time completely and utterly destroying everything around him. You have the head of household, Chris Kleek, who finds the woman brilliantly played and brought to life by Pollyanna McIntosh, and brings her home, chains her up to civilize her, and sucks his son and daughter and wife into the despicably intense trials and tribulations that result from what he has set out to do. The woman is nothing short of emotionally damaging. I don't think it's as graphic and disturbing as some people who have flipped out about its content say it is, but then again, you and I have seen and experienced a lot in genre films, so we may be a bit desensitized. But The Woman at number six, written by Jack Ketchum, and as I said, directed by Lucky McKee. And I'm going to take a quick break to cough and gag my way back to some kind of normalcy. And we're going to finish up with the top five films of 2011. All right, kiddos, here we go. Number five, Kevin Smith's Red State. Not a huge fan of Kevin Smith, not a Kevin Smith hater, but this certainly was something I was very interested and intrigued with when I heard that he was doing a dark film. Incredible performances from Michael Parks as Psycho Pastor Eamon Cooper, Alyssa Leo as Sarah, John Goodman as Agent. Fuck. Total brain fart right there, due to the fact that my dear wife is texting me while I'm doing this. Joseph Keenan as Agent Joseph Keenan. The script written by Smith is really dense and topical. You essentially, get this group of religious nuts who abduct these three young men, and you find out that they got a whole lot of hatred towards the world around them and those that aren't following what, according to them, is God's law, and all the horror that transpires within their home, and then the subsequent chaos that occurs when ATF agents come on the scene to subdue them at all costs. I was excited about this film, and I have to be honest with you that how much I liked it not only shocked me, but knocked me on my ass. And I think it's incredible, and it's a very disturbing and, again, topical look at, the evil that's in this world that masquerades as goodness. Number four is Absentia. This is a film that I saw pretty early on in 2011, and it stayed with me and stuck on the list. You can check the website for an interview with writer-director Mike Flanagan and the two stars of the film, Katie Parker, who plays Callie, and Courtney Bell, who plays Trisha, her older sister, who 7 years ago lost her husband Daniel, played by Morgan Peter Brown. And what an incredibly visually impactful and emotionally stirring story this is. Again, the two performances from Parker and Bell, they're almost serendipitous. It's just a revelation to watch these two women bounce off each other, instigate and antagonize one another, and then kind of collapse in on one another. The visual atmosphere, intensity that's brought to the viewer through what you see, think you see, and don't see. Things that you hear, things that are there in the real world and are there lurking behind every corner, it seems, make this film one of the absolute most chilling movies I've seen in a long time. But certainly this year, it turned into, one of those really, really intense experiences for me, and I absolutely love it. So, number four is Absentia, and me oh my, the top three, huh? Number three, The Last Circus. Alex de la Iglesia is the director, and if you're not familiar with his filmography, check him out on IMDb. He is a mad genius. His films are absolutely crazy. And this movie, which is absolutely dripping with atmosphere and reverence for the world that it's recreating, is ridiculously brilliant and intense to look at. Performances by Carlos Areces as Javier, Antonio de la Torre as Sergio, and Carolina Bang as Natalia. Essentially, you have 1937, we're in the middle of the Spanish Civil War. We have a happy circus clown who is pulled into the military and forced to fight. We move ahead to 1973, and Javier wants to follow in the footsteps of his father, but because of all the tragedy he's experienced in his life, he ultimately has no choice but to follow his destiny and become the sad clown. Kick ahead, he's picked up by a circus, and you have Sergio, who is the happy clown, whose job is to humiliate the sad clown in the performances. However, Sergio just happens to be a fucking psycho who is involved with Natalia. We get an intense love triangle that develops. Every character, it seems, goes off their rocker, and it all culminates and crescendos into one of the most mentally and emotionally anguished films that I've ever experienced, and it's a bloody, brutal, emotionally taxing joyride. And if you haven't seen it, I cannot recommend it enough. It's clocks in just under 2 hours, and every second of that runtime is an absolute joy. So that brings us to our number two film of the year, and that one is A Horrible Way to Die. Written by Simon Barrett, directed by Adam Wingard, starring A.J. Bowen as Garrick Terrell, Amy Simetz as Sarah, and let's go ahead and throw Joe Swanberg in there as Kevin. This was my number one film of the year for a while, until the number one film came along. But I will undoubtedly say that Amy Simetz is my performance of the year. I don't divide things up into best actor, best actress. Y'all should have to fight each other for the title, and Amy clearly won that title. The film for me took a tiny bit of getting used to visually. Wingard has a flair and a technical box of tools, if you will, that he uses when filming. And this one took a minute for me to kind of readjust to, but I found it to actually intensify the storytelling and pull you in even more fully. It's a bleak film. It looks and feels hopeless, and it really is emotionally jarring. Bowen is fucking fantastic as Garrick Terrell, who incidentally happens to be a serial killer who was in a relationship with Sarah, and Sarah found out about his extracurricular activities. Terrell was arrested, subsequently escaped. Now he's looking for Sarah, who is an absolute shell of a human being, a pathetic, sad, emotionally damaged and scarred young woman. And if this film doesn't pull you in and shatter your soul, I don't know what will. From beginning to end, I was just glued to it. And as I said, this was my number one film of the year, right up until I forced myself, because of the director involved, who's one of my absolute favorites, again, forced myself to go to a movie theater because I hate movie theaters, because of Nicholas Winding Refn, to see Drive. Ryan Gosling as Driver and Carey Mulligan as Irene. And of course, some other incredibly dense performances from Albert Brooks as Bernie Rose, Ron Perlman as Nino, geez, Bryan Cranston as Shannon, Oscar Isaac as Standard, Christina Hendricks is in here as Blanche. But this movie just threw me for a loop. It brought me back to many years ago when I would be absolutely awestruck at the big screen and the big sound. By now, you all know what this movie's about. If you haven't seen it, shame on you. If you've seen it and didn't like it, I'm not gonna flip out if you didn't love it like I did. I mean, this was seriously an epiphany for me. It was like an earth-shattering, groundbreaking moment in my life, because I'd lost all hope for the cinema. You know, I had my roots firmly planted into independent filmmaking that unfortunately was not even sniffing the local multiplex. And to have a film like this show up in, your run-of-the-mill commercialized theater blew me away. I think that Ryan Gosling was just absolutely phenomenal as Driver. So silent, so strong, and the film kind of, sweeps you along in this this tragic love story that essentially turns out to be, doing anything within your power to protect someone, and in the process, the major consequence of ensuring their safety means never being able to experience, that love again. At the heart of it, it's odd to say it, but it is a love story. But it's also a very brutal illustration of the lengths that people are willing to go to for very admirable causes, but also for no reason at all. There are terrible things done in this film, under the guise of pride and, chest bumping and thumping, and the chemistry between Mulligan and Gosling is just incredible, and Carey Mulligan as Irene, it just brings an incredibly soft and tender balance to what Driver is. There's certainly action in the film, and the kills, when they happen, are intensely punctuated moments of gruesome violence. And for me, there's really something for everyone in this film. I saw it and subsequently took my wife back to see it, and she loved it as well. And I can't speak highly enough about Drive. Once it got inside me, it was pretty clear that it was going to be the number one film. So check that out if you haven't seen it. Nicholas Winding Refn, REFN. Check him out on IMDb. If you have not seen any or all of his films, please see any and all of them, from Pusher, Bleeder, Pusher 2, Pusher 3, Bronson, Valhalla Rising, and Drive. He is an absolute master craftsman, and one of my absolute favorite filmmakers of all time. And I thank you so much for tuning in to listen to my top films of the year, short and feature length. I have to say, I've been getting a few questions about the film Insidious, particularly from my good friend Tom. I'm putting you on the spot again. A lot of people, including Tom, want to know why I didn't like Insidious. As I said, the first two acts were interesting and atmospheric and creepy enough to keep me engaged, but I really, really feel like it just totally went off the rails in the third act. And I don't care about, if it was believable or not, because, from kind of shot one, you need to suspend, disbelief, which I'm fine with. Many of the films that we watch, they have to do that. But it just, I think that there was, for me, some miscasting. I loved Lin Shaye in it. I didn't really have a problem with the silliness that was brought on, to a degree during the paranormal investigation. I just, for some reason, I hated Patrick Wilson in this. I really did. And she just didn't work for me, or he didn't work for me, sorry. And then, like I said, the third act where he goes into, geez, I don't want to give too much away if you haven't seen it, but when he goes where he goes in the third act, and then the whole reveal at the end, it didn't sit well with me, Tom. I'm sorry. But on another note, I wanted to point everybody over to Tom's website. It's all the colors of the dark.com, and all kinds of really incredible artwork there on display. But now that Tom is back into the land of the living, he did his reflections of 2011, which is just really fascinating because he gets into music, he does his films of the year, and then he also talks about some of the great TV that he's gotten to see. And it's the things that he writes with each of them. I love the way Tom writes because he really is thoughtful and gets into it in good depth. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the band that he is in, The Other Side of Morning, Letters from Your Love, The Madman. That's in his Reflections of 2011 as well. But go ahead and check that out. All the colors of the dark.com. You can also check out a really good year-end list over at dementedcinema.com. Scott and Steve and Luna over there do a great job, and Scott's year-end list was pretty fantastic and detailed. And I want to wrap up by letting you know that next episode, we're going to be doing a feature-length film commentary again, and this one is going to be for the French film Inside, and this is for my dear friend Paula. Paula, you know who you are, who I had promised that I would do this, what seems like over a year ago, and I'm finally going to get to it. So check that out next episode, and be sure to stop by theconduitspeaks.com. Again, all the colors of the dark.com, dementedcinema.com. Let's see. I hope you all have an incredible start to 2012. And remember, make change in your life, positive change, set goals, and work towards them on a daily basis. Fuck New Year's resolutions. They're just setting you up for failure. In any event, Chris Conduit, the Conduit Speaks podcast. I will talk to you soon. Thanks, guys. Bye.